right, we're ready for Luke chapter 21 in our study this morning. And we have some ground to cover. As you recall, chapter 21 is parallel to Matthew 24, Mark 13. So there's a great deal in the chapter, a lot of information, a lot of misunderstanding concerning those chapters. We'll get to that underway in just a moment. This is our outline that we're following. We are in the final section, the final tragedy and triumph, which according to Baxter starts in chapter 19 in verse 45 and goes through the end of the book. And we are in Passion Week. We'll get to that in just a moment. But let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1 was... Yeah, birth of John, the announcement of Jesus. Good. Chapter 2. Yeah, birth and childhood of Jesus. Good. Chapter 3. Preaching of John. Good. Chapter 4. All right, that's the beginning of his Galilean ministry. Very good. Chapter 5. All right, good. Chapter 6. Yeah, and that's the abbreviated version of the Sermon on the Mount. Very good. That's chapters 5 to 7 of Matthew by comparison. Chapter 7. Yeah, miracles and commendation of John. That's where John sent two of his disciples out. Chapter 8. All right, very good. Parables and miracles. Chapter 9, discipleship, parallel to Matthew chapter 8, by the way. chapter 10. All right, we're seeing the spread of this message. Chapter 11 dealt with opposition to that message as well as prayer. I'm trying to speed the time up just a little bit. The warning and instructions to the disciples as they carry this message forth. We'll see a little more about that in our study today. And then we have the rebuke of the Jews in parables. Chapter 14. Cost of following Christ. Chapter 15. There were three parables that focused on value of the lost. Very good. Chapter 16. All right. Unjust steward and the rich man and Lazarus. We all should remember the rich man and Lazarus, Luke 16. The only account of that. Chapter 17. Yeah, forgiveness and faith. Chapter 18. All right, parables and the rich young ruler. Now, chapter 19 ought to stand out because this is where enter the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Yes. So this is the beginning of what we could refer to as Passion Week, the last week of the life of Christ. More about that in a moment. Chapter 20, last time. Yeah, confrontation with the Jews. Chapter 21, question one for today. What is this chapter about? What's the main point? Destruction of Jerusalem. We'll get to that in just a moment. I want to start at the end of the chapter, lest we run out of time and we don't get there, because this has been a question since we got started in Matthew. Not only this time, but in our previous cycle concerning this Wednesday. If you're keeping up with the days, if you haven't or haven't been here, let's trace just a little bit quickly if we can. Starting in chapter 19, beginning at verse 28, this was his triumphal entry. That was on Sunday. So if you want to keep up with the week, you might put a marginal note that this is Sunday, out to the margin of Luke chapter 19, beginning at verse 28. Then we get to the end of the chapter at verse 45. The cleansing of the temple took place on Monday. Might make a marginal note there. All right. Then in chapter 20, this confrontation. This is parallel to Matthew 22, Matthew 23, by comparison. And that takes place on Tuesday. Make a marginal note there at verse 1 of chapter 20, Tuesday. All right, we get over here to chapter 21. You might make another marginal note. This is still Tuesday. This is that day. Now, there's a question about Wednesday, and that's why we're going to the end of the chapter. Let's go to verse 37 and 38. Make a note there, or at least make some observations. There either is no record of that Wednesday, because we start with the triumphal entry and come up to Tuesday. Then how do we determine what took place Thursday, Friday, and Saturday and Sunday? We start with him being raised on the first day and back up, and that's how we end up with the Thursday being the day of the observing the Passover, his trial, and Gethsemane, etc. Make sense? So we're left with that Wednesday. What took place on that Wednesday? We either have no record that something took place, but we either have no record, or Luke 21 37 and 38 is the only insight. So I know what we'll do. We'll run out of time and won't get to talk about that. So let's talk about that now. Let's go to verse 37. This is not really a continuation of the thought of the previous part of the chapter. This is a comment about Jesus' practice of teaching that week. And the text says, in the daytime, he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and stayed at the Mount of Olivet, just a little bit ways from Jerusalem. Then early in the morning, all the people came to him in the temple to hear him. So there's some discussion about that among commentators. What's that saying? There is nothing earth-shattering here. There's nothing that's going to change your faith. It's not going to change a doctrinal stance. It's just a little insight. Does this passage tell me anything about that Wednesday? Some think that the text is talking about the immediate day, and that night he went out to the Mount of Olivet, and then the next morning, being Wednesday, he came back to the temple to teach. If so, then there's teaching done on that Wednesday. Most think, and this is probably correct, that the verses 37 and 38 is talking about his practice for that week, at least from Sunday through Wednesday, because we know after he observed the Passover, he doesn't go back teaching in the temple because he's on trial, and then he's crucified, and he's in the tomb, and then he's raised from the dead. So that would only apply to the first part of the week. And that the passage is actually saying this was his practice for that week. He would come to the temple and teach. He would go out to the Mount of Olives and rest for the evening. Then he would come back to the temple and teach, which may imply that that included even that Wednesday. I'm concluding that the text is telling me one way or the other that he probably taught in the temple on that Wednesday. Now, is that earth-shattering? No, it's just a little insight. It's the only passage I know of that tells me anything about that Wednesday. I don't think anything in John is there. There's nothing in Mark. There's nothing in Matthew. And so if you want to know anything about that Wednesday, you're going to get it out of verse 37 and 38. If you can't squeeze it out of that, you don't know anything about Wednesday, really. Make sense? And you think you can't squeeze anything out of that, then you don't know nothing about Wednesday. I think I could squeeze a little bit out of that, maybe, and if you understand my terminology there. All right, with that in mind, that's why we've been raising the question. Either there's no record or he did some teaching. All right, let's talk about what's found in chapter 21. In chapter 21, there are two major thoughts. There is the widow with the two mites, verses 1 to 4, very familiar story. Then there is the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, we've been through the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, and another parallel text would be Mark 13. So you want to remember those chapters, particularly Matthew 24. It seems to be the more thorough study of the question. So any information we need, we might go back and find in Matthew 24. Does that make sense? All right. So let's talk about the widow with the two mites, first of all. And say several things about this. Let's go to question number two. What is the point, or what's to be learned from the widow who gave two mites? She sacrificed all she had. All right, she sacrificed all she had. All right. But, go ahead. Absolutely. That's what I'm wanting to focus on, what Ricky, it's true. She gave sacrificially, but this is in contrast. Say again. Contrast to the scribes in the previous chapter. We noted at the end of chapter 20 concerning the scribes, and they, notice at verse 46, they have the long robes and the greetings, the marketplaces and the best seats, and they devour wood. They're hypocrites. So in contrast to that hypocrisy, which has just been observed, that same day, he's talked about that. Here comes some people in giving a great amount, and here's this widow who gives everything she has. Make sense? What a contrast. Now let's work through that and see what we have. In verse 1, he saw the rich putting in their gifts into the treasury. Now Mark 12 is a parallel account to this, which gives us a little more information, beginning at verse 41. Mark says they were giving much. Luke doesn't tell us that, but they were giving much into the accounts. Some writers talk about perhaps, this would be based on Jewish tradition, I think, but that the containers in which they dumped their money would be something of a circular end of a trumpet type thing, in other words, a metal container, so that noise would be made as you put money in, thinking perhaps that the more you give, the more noise it makes, and it makes it sound like you're really giving a lot. So if you could imagine pouring money in where it's just making a lot of noise of the coins, the more you pour in, it seems like you're giving more. And here comes somebody, and you hardly even hear the sound because of the two mites. And there is a point to be made about that. But anyway, at verse 2, this widow gave two mites. Mark 12:42 says the two mites make a quadrant. That probably doesn't help you a lot, does it? So look at your footnote, and it says that's a Roman coin. That doesn't help you much either, does it? let's talk about the mite, and then we'll come back to some things that we learn here in this context. This is a picture from the internet of a widow's mite, and that corresponds with anything I've seen with reference to the widow's mite. Our late brother Eugene Gross bought this widow's mite for me to use, and this is a certified copy of that, or at least a certified coin. And you see that's very similar. The design is very similar. It's turned and rotated. But by comparison of size, there's a penny right there. It's the smallest of the coins, insignificant coin. We'll talk about its value in just a moment. Here is one you can take a look at. Sue Smith is wearing this one this morning. Stephen bought this when he was in Palestine. There's the certification of that. It's made into a necklace. She's wearing that. You can take a look after services. That's a widow's mite. It's the smallest of the coins. Now, what's the value of that coin? It was the smallest. It's similar to, though probably less value than our penny. But if you can imagine somebody having two of the smallest coins we have, in contrast to someone giving thousands and thousands, and they just have two of the smallest coins. Caldwell, in his work, says that a mite was 1/18 of a daily wage. That doesn't sound like much, does it? And I think he doesn't agree with some, a more common estimation of the value. The NET translation scripture note, as you are probably aware, the NET gives a lot of technical notes in the scriptures note or some of the other type of notes. They argue, and so do other writers, that it is 1/128, 1/128 of a denarius. In other words, 1/128 of a daily wage. The scripture note says that that's probably equal to 6 minutes of a daily wage. So whatever you got paid for the hourly wage, that's about 6 minutes worth of pay is what that would be. Does that make sense? We're talking about a little insignificant amount. So comparison to our day, that may have reference just to a few coins. Some have estimated it may be worth $2 in our based upon what our salary would be for the day, whatever. I'm not sure. But the point is, she gave very little. But not only did she give very little, but she gave everything she had. What do you learn from that?
She valued herself more than she did her money.
All right. She valued her relationship to God more than she did her money. What else?
She sacrificed.
Say again.
She trusted that God would provide for her.
Very good. That's good.
She gave great sacrifice for the Pharisees, just gave out of his abundance.
Yeah.
She gave her a sacrifice to her. Like David.
Yeah.
David said he would sacrifice nothing to the Lord, that's a cost himself.
Yeah, good point. Good point. You take a billionaire who gives $1 million, that's not much. But you take somebody that's that hardly has enough to eat on, and they give $2 or $3, that was a pretty good sacrifice. I've known of occasions where Christians were raising money, not as a church, but for some benefit that they're raising money for. And I've known of people coming giving $10 or $20, and I knew at the circumstance well enough that they probably missed a meal that week to give that $10. They didn't have it. That's a sacrifice versus someone saying, well, I'll give $1,000 because I'll never miss that. I'm making lots of money, have lots of money. There is nothing in this that diminishes the giving of those who are wealthy, but it's focusing on this woman and her giving. One writer said Jesus viewed as priceless what the world views as worthless. If you were one of the rich people standing over here and said, look what she gave. She gave just two mites, two pennies, two copper coins. And that's just worthless. But God viewed it as priceless. Now you may have to think on this one for a moment. I agree with this, but Caldwell quotes from Marshall who said, it matters not the amount that one gives, but the amount that one keeps for himself. I agree with that. See, those who gave a lot kept a lot for themselves. She didn't keep anything for herself. God doesn't care about the amount you give, it's how much you keep for yourself. In other words, you may give more than this widow gave, but you're keeping a lot more for yourself. And there's a lesson in that. Now I want you to go to verse 2 and verse 3. There's some lesson here about Jesus exercising divine knowledge. There's no indication she come and told him, I gave all, but he knew that was all she had. She knew how much she gave. There is no indication that there was an announcement, I'm giving this large amount or I'm only giving two mites. She comes in and throws her two mites in, and Jesus knew that, and he also knew it was all she had. There were again some insight to the disciples. Any questions or comments on that before we move on? We're going to move to the destruction of Jerusalem. All right, let's talk about the destruction of Jerusalem. We have the same format in Luke 21 and in Mark 13 and in Matthew 24. Not all the same information, and we'll flag that for you as we go along. But we have the same structure. There is an announcement. There are questions, though only one is mentioned here. And then there are answers to those questions. Does that make sense? Let's look at the announcement first. Verses 5 and 6. This is on Tuesday of Passion Week, and Jesus makes an announcement. And what is the announcement? Yeah. Temple's going to be destroyed. Some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned. They're observing. They're in the temple area as Jesus is teaching. And they're observing the magnificent temple and how it's adorned with precious stones. And the beautiful stones and donations. And as for these things, you see, the days will come when not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Well, to the Jew, that sounds like the end of the world, doesn't it? That there's not one stone here left in this city that will not be torn down. Even the walls of the city will be torn down and the city will be destroyed. Jesus is talking about what's going to take place in AD 70 when Titus the Roman general brought his army in and utterly destroyed the city. From that point on, there was such utter destruction, there is not a Jew living now that can tell you what tribe they're of. All records are gone. Does that make sense? Utter destruction. That is the end of the world. Now let's go to question in their sense. Let's go to the question or questions in verse 7. What was the question? Yeah, when's this going to take place? Now you might flag Matthew 24 and in verse 3. It is a parallel account. Though Luke doesn't record that for us, Matthew does. There were actually two questions they ask. When will these things be? And what was the second question? And the end of the age. Now in the mind of the Jew, those are the same thing. And several commentators make that point. That's really one question. I don't care if it was one in their mind. Jesus distinguishes those two. Does that make sense? Jesus distinguishes the end of the age from the destruction of Jerusalem, but in their mind it's the same. So they really ask two questions, and Matthew makes it clearer that he answers two questions. But Luke makes it clear as well. And we're going to flag that too if you're so disposed to mark your Bible. So I put questions here, and you might mark in your Bible at Luke that there are actually two questions. When will this happen, the destruction of Jerusalem, and when will the end of the age be? Now, there again, in their mind, that is the end of the age. It's all over for us. You must be talking about the end of time. All right, now we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about the answer that he gives to that in Luke chapter 21. So let's see what the answers are. He talks about some things before the tribulation. Now let's get ahead of ourselves. The tribulation is using terminology from Daniel 9, which prophesied of the destruction of Jerusalem. We're going to flag that in a moment. Daniel 9 is alluded to in Luke 21. It is quoted in Matthew 24. Does that make sense? That's how I know we're talking about Daniel 9. I'm not guessing at that. I know. Because Matthew tells us that. All right? So he talks about some things that will take place before that tribulation, that is, this utter destruction of the city. He'll talk about the destruction itself. And then he's going to talk about what takes place after that destruction. Then he talks about when all that's going to take place. So he gives us a lot of information here. So let's talk about before the tribulation. Ignore the bottom of the slide. We'll get to that in a moment. Some things that Matthew adds that are not found here. So before this all takes place, the question was, when is it going to take place? There's going to be what? First of all, verse 8. There's going to be false Christ. There's going to be people coming saying, I'm the Messiah. And he's going to lead you off into the wilderness. And don't follow him. Don't go after him. If you want more details on that, there's several pages in Caldwell's work where he talks about some examples of where that took place. And we don't have time to get into that, but if you're interested in pursuing that, I refer you to Collie Caldwell's work. So there's going to be some false Christ, people rising up claiming I'm the Christ. Then there's going to be, at verse 9 and 10, what? There's going to be wars, and there's going to be rumors of war, and there's going to be nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Now, you might have a marginal note in Matthew 24. If you do, go over here and check and see if you do. If not, maybe you want to put one. In Matthew 24, we made this point that the Roman period of peace is soon coming to an end. There was tension that was building by 50 AD. That's 20 years before this destruction. There were Jewish wars that were waged from 65 AD to 72 AD. This is right in the middle of that. So there is all kinds of wars. At Caesarea, 20,000 Jews died. Alexander in Egypt, 50,000 died. At Damascus, 10,000 died. There was war after war and tension that built from 65 to 72, and 70 is right there in the middle of all of that. So there's going to be wars going on. There's rumors of war. Now, this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. We're going to flag a passage in Luke 21 that's going to confirm that for us. But how is that passage misused today? Yeah. The premillennialists argue that this is talking about the second coming, and here are the signs that are telling us the second coming is coming near. And so every time there is a war breaks out in the Middle East, or there is gunfights, or a bunch get killed and there's bombs going off, this is part of the signs of the time, end of time. Not so. This is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem coming. Now let's look at verse 11. Verse 11 says there's going to be natural calamity. There's going to be great earthquakes. The word great suggests mega earthquakes, seismic earthquakes. They would measure large on the Richter scale. This were not just minor little quivers. Major earthquakes in various places. There would be famines and pestilence. Now, here's something that's added. And let's take the time to flag four verses. I know there's only three. I didn't put the fourth one up there. And we'll do that here in just a second. If you want to flag verses that are only mentioned in Luke, meaning Luke is the only one that mentions this of these three accounts, Mark 13, Matthew 24, Luke 21. And only Luke mentions, Matthew mentions the earthquakes and the famines and the pestilence, but the fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Luke is the only one that mentions that. That's just a little interesting thought to me. You might go ahead and flag verse 20, being surrounded by the armies. Jerusalem will be surrounded by the armies. Luke is the only one that mentions that. I skip verse 18. Verse 18, but a hair of your hair will not be lost. Luke is the only one that mentions that. And then verse 24, concerning Jerusalem be trampled by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Luke is the only one that mentions that. Is that helpful? It is for me. I go to looking for that in Matthew and I can't find that. All right. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to beginning at verse 12. There's persecution going to take place. What's going to take place in the persecution? Say again.
The disciples will
disciples are going to be persecuted, and persecuted severely. They'll persecute you, deliver you to the synagogues and to prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers, and they will, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. So every time you're arrested, every time you're persecuted, it's an occasion to give testimony to the word of the Lord. You'll be able to talk about the gospel. They will settle, therefore settle in your hearts not to meditate before how you will answer. This is instructions given to the apostles. You say, how do you know? Matthew 10, flag Matthew 10, 18 to 20. This was instructions given to the apostles that when they were called into question, they didn't have to stop and take thought, well, how am I going to answer that? What am I going to say? Well, how would they know what they're going to say then? Yeah, Holy Spirit would tell them. Again, flag Matthew 10, 18 to 20 is a parallel thought, or parallel in structure, parallel, not a parallel text, but a parallel thought in Matthew chapter 10. Now, let's go on and get verse 18 and 19. Let's come down to that. I want you to notice verse 16. There, you'll be betrayed even by parents and brothers, and they will send some of you even to your death. So it's not going to be easy. There's going to be persecution all take place before the tribulation. It's going to rise. It's going to get severe. It's going to get tough. And some of you even go to your death, and you'll be hated for my name's sake. Now, verse 18, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. Sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Some of you are going to be killed, but not a hair of your head will be lost. Luke's the only one mentions that. Matthew doesn't. Mark doesn't. No other text mentions that. So what's that talking about? It cannot be promising physical protection. Some of you are going to be killed, but God's going to give you physical protection, so you're not killed. Now, wait a minute. Something isn't right here. That's a contradiction. The point is, God's not going to forsake them. There is going to be no lasting harm done. Their spiritual well-being will be intact. This is hard sometimes for us to comprehend, depends on the period of time in our life, but death is not a big deal to God. I've made that point several times. That's just not a big deal to God. So why did he allow some of his disciples to be killed? Because death's not a big deal to God. Because time that we're in is just a little short thing compared to eternity. Death's just not a big deal to God. And so why did he allow some to be killed, and yet he says that not a hair of your head? You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay in the midst of that. Now, verse 19 helps me with that. In your patience, possess your souls. Some New King James says, by your patience, possess your souls. English Standard says, by your endurance, you'll save your lives. I think that's your spiritual life. I don't think you're patient and you're going to save your life when some of you are going to face death. It must be the spiritual welfare. Does that make sense? Otherwise, we end up with a contradiction, and that's not going to work. Yes, ma'am. He avoided. Yeah. And perhaps you've seen that in your own life. There have been people who you thought died prematurely, and then later on you realize they didn't have to go through what some of the rest of us saw. And it wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing. All right.
Persecution will come, but we need to stand fast.
That's right. Now, here's some things in Matthew 24 that's not found in Luke 21, for what that may be worth to you, that before the tribulation there will be false prophets, sin will abound, there's going to be apathy and indifference, and then the gospel is going to spread to the Gentiles. Luke doesn't talk about that. I'm not sure that that's what verse 24 is about. Some think, well, yeah, he does. He mentioned verse 24. I don't think so. I don't think that's parallel to Matthew 24's reference to the Gentiles. I'll suggest something about that here in a moment. All right. Let's move on now to the tribulation itself. Verse 20 says, and Luke's only one mentions this, if you didn't flag that a moment ago, that you'll see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. That's the Roman army led by Titus, who was sent. And you know the desolation is near. So here's some things that are going to take place before the tribulation. But when you see the Roman army gathering around Jerusalem, better look out. Getting close, real close. It's about to happen. Now then, verse 21, 22, 23 says they are to flee. I know this is not talking about the second coming. Why? Yeah, you can't run, you can't flee. Where are you going to go? So, those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in her midst depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. If you're outside the city of Jerusalem, don't come in. If you're in Jerusalem, you get out. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. I'll come back to the fulfillment and how we know that. Let's go and get verse 23. Those who are pregnant, those who are nursing babies, what does he say about them? Going to be hard. Because those with children, small children, are about to have children, fleeing is going to be a little difficult. So woe to those who face that in those days. Now we'll get the rest of verse 23 in a moment. Let's go back to this fulfillment. You might make a marginal note if you don't have that. Daniel 9, 23 to 27 is the prophecy. And you say, well, how do you know that's the prophecy that he's speaking of? Because Matthew 24, 15 quotes from Daniel 9 and talks about the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel. That is a quotation from Daniel 9, 23 to 27. And Jesus says the destruction of Jerusalem is the fulfillment of that. So that helps me then when I get to Daniel 9. I'm not going to go to Daniel 9 right now. But when I'm studying Daniel 9, you'll hear me say, I know Daniel 9 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. You say, how do you know? Because Jesus said so in Matthew 24, 15. Make sense? So how do I know Luke 21 and in verse 22 is talking about Daniel 9? Matthew 24, 15 told me so. Does that make sense? All right. Now then, there's going to be great tribulation during this time. It's going to be terrible. What do we know about that? Verse 23 and 24. It's going to be great distress, stress on the land, wrath upon the people. Some are going to fall by the... Some will be taken captive. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles. That's the Roman army. Jerusalem's going to be overrun and controlled now by Gentiles. The Jews had control of that. Gentiles take over. Now here's a difficult phrase. Until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So well, I know what that's talking about. The gospel going to the Gentiles. Well, that's already happened by AD 70. That's already happened. Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 11. So what's he talking about? The answer that I'm sure of saying is, I don't know. I think what it's talking about is, and it may refer to the Gentiles' domination of Jerusalem and Judea. And so, when they took over Jerusalem, do they have control of the region? Not complete control, but they will in time. So there's going to be this desolation until they have control, till the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. They're going to have control of that. Does that make sense? So that's the tribulation. That's when the Roman army comes in and utterly destroys the city like you've never seen before. Matthew makes this point. Matthew makes the point that there's been nothing like this before, nor will there be anything like this afterwards. At least for the Jews, nothing like this. AD 70 was a monumental point. All right, let's go to 25 to 28. What happens here? All right, very good. Yeah, here's some things that after the Roman army marches in and utterly destroys, here's some things that take place. Now, this is where, let's stop and learn something very practical. This is where having a knowledge of the Old Testament and Old Testament terminology is helpful. So you say, well, I just like to study the New Testament. I don't like studying Isaiah. I don't like Daniel. I don't care about those books. I don't like Leviticus. Well, when you get to the book of Hebrews, for example, you're not going to understand unless you know something about Leviticus. There are things in the New Testament that we better understand if we understand Old Testament terminology. Make sense? All right, let's see how that works.
Verse 25 and 26, I simply summarize that by saying there's going to be a change in order, a downfall of nations. There's going to be an utter change in order. The Jewish nation is going to crumble. How so? Well, he said there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and the stars, and on the earth distress of the nation with perplexity, the sea of the waves roaring. Well, we'll come back to verse 26. He's borrowing language from Isaiah 13 and 10. If you want to make a reference to that, in Ezekiel 32, 7 to 9. Let's take Isaiah 13. The downfall of Babylon. Babylon was a world empire, much like the Soviet Union at one point, or like the United States, a major empire. And it's going to fall. And God described it as the sun being turned to darkness and the moon into blood. Remember that? And you say, well, is that literal? No, it's not literal. It's terminology. And I've pictured this several times before. What if you got up in the morning, turned the news on, and find out Washington is completely destroyed? There's not a leader left. And the White House, the Capitol, the Supreme Court, the Pentagon, everything is wiped out. Our military is completely wiped out. Communication is gone. It'd be like the sun didn't shine that day. Let me tell you. It'd be like the moon's turned into blood. Like the stars are not shining. You wake up one morning and Jerusalem has been destroyed and you're a Jew. It's like the sun's not shining. It's a downfall of the nations. Now let's get verse 27 and 28. Our time is running out. Then you'll see the Son of Man coming on a cloud. I do not think that's reference to the second coming. And I'm going to flag why in just a second. But it has to him coming in judgment. There are a number of passages that talk about him coming in judgment. So when will this happen? 29 to 33. Well, let's flag this if we don't get anything else before we get through and our time's about out. Look at verse 31. You might underline some of this. So also when you see, the things that he's been talking about are things that those listening to him are going to see. Does that make sense? You will see that. Then he says at verse 33, this generation will by no means pass till all these things take place. What does he mean by that? Those living then would be living when that takes place. Very good. All right. Now we have a transition point. Mark that in your Bible. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Lest your heart be weighed with carousing and drunkenness and cares of life. And that day, what day? Heaven and earth pass away. That's the end of time. He just made a transition point. Did the same thing in Matthew 24, same thing in Mark 13. Go back and see if you didn't make notes there. Make sense? He made a transition point. Now, Luke does not record they had asked about the end of time. But Matthew did. So that's why he includes that here. Those things that he talked about, even if you take the view that verse 33, 34 and on is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, I know without a doubt from 32 and above is all talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in that day and time, not the second coming. Because they would see it, that generation would not die till that comes pass. Make sense? Your key to understanding, question number five, your key is verse 32. Does that make sense to you? And then finally, and our time is gone, he talks about watching. I'm convinced verse 34, 35, 36 talks about watching for the second coming and being prepared for that. Now you may say, I think that's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem still. Okay, have at it. I think it's dealing with the second coming. But here we have before the tribulation, after the tribulation, when it takes place, and then be watchful for the end of time. And then here's some comments on his teaching. And we started there because we're here and we're out of time. I knew we would be. We're done.